Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to Independent Americans. Welcome to episode 118. I'm your host, Paul Rykoff. And welcome to summer 2021. Now, more than any other time, now, even as we're enjoying the start of summer, now is still a time to stay vigilant. But it's also a time to celebrate the reopening, to celebrate the end of school, to celebrate the NBA playoffs, to celebrate Trump not being in the White House, and to celebrate music, sunshine, family, and being together again. It's also a time to celebrate, to go for a long drive, to go for a big hike, and to spend time with all the people you've missed. And it's a time to laugh. And I'm going to flash you back to one of our most popular episodes ever, one of our most downloaded episodes ever, and one of my favorite episodes ever. Episode 78 from September of last year with the great Stephen Colbert. I got a chance to interview Stephen from his house just weeks before the election. It was humbling, it was inspiring, it was funny as hell. And this is one of the most candid interviews you'll ever hear. I've known Stephen for a long time now, and he really opens up about politics, about life, about family, and about the future. And please be sure to subscribe to this pod if you haven't before, and share. And you can find this video and all others, over 100 episodes, at independentamericans.us. It's all free, and I hope it helps you make your summer just a little bit sweeter. Because damn, after the last year and a half, we've earned it. Here it is, my conversation with the great Stephen Colbert. I hope you enjoy it. Stay vigilant, people. Ladies and gentlemen, angry Americans around the country and around the world. This is the guest I've been looking forward to having on this show since I first conceived of it. He is a man I admire. He is a man I appreciate. He's a man I've been honored to know now for maybe almost two decades. I think he's a conscience. I think he's getting us through some really crazy times. And he's one of the nicest people I've ever met in this whole weird political media entertainment business. I am honored to have us joined by the great and powerful Stephen Colbert.
Hey, Paul, good to see you.
I feel like I need reverb or echo or something as you enter this.
Do it in post. Do it in post.
I don't have any post, man.
This is it.
This is it, man. I'm in my. You can see I'm in my kid's bedroom. You know.
Oh, nice.
This is improvise, adapt, and overcome, as we say.
That is nice. Those are some quality decals on the wall.
Octonauts. Are you familiar with Octonauts?
My youngest is 18. I do not know the Octonauts. Octonauts?
Octonauts. They are a heroic group of underwater heroes that regularly save the world and teach about marine biology along the way. If they were running our government, we'd be in so much better hands right now.
Good.
But thank you for joining me. I'm so honored to have you. Let me ask you a question I've been asking everybody from the beginning. We've known each other almost two decades now.
Yeah.
The question I ask of everybody since the pandemic started is, where are you and how are you?
I'm home. I'm home. I'm in a home office that we set up 12 years ago, and I did not start using till 2 months ago. Because I always had an office to go to in the city. And I really like it. I it's really nice to be home. I love the ability to be able to go downstairs and have lunch with my wife. That's nice. So I'm at home. I did the first 5 months of COVID in South Carolina, which is where I grew up and where my wife grew up. And her family's down there. My family's still down there. So that was really great. We, you know, besides the strangeness and of course the disquiet and the sort of this, the general anxiety associated with COVID right now, it was really sort of fascinating to be in my hometown for a long period of time, especially in the spring, which I hadn't done since I was 18 years old. And, you know, you always wonder, can you go home again? Mm. You know, especially even if you love it, can you go home again and make a life later, you know, later in your own life there? And boy, I'm just sold. I'm sold on South Carolina. I just love the people and I love the place just as much as I ever did. It was an interesting window into what is possible now, especially since you can do your show anywhere now, evidently. You know, ratings are great. I happen to be in South Carolina. That's a dangerous thing for me to discover. But now I'm back up here in the New York area. And how am I? Damn lucky is how I am. Mm. You know, not only am I healthy, luckily, I have some members of my family that have contracted COVID, but everyone's been fine so far. With various degrees of it, you know, manifesting itself in symptoms. I've been very lucky. And I'm lucky to be able to go to work. You know, I feel for everybody who not only has the anxiety, but A, doesn't have the income, doesn't have that daily sense of purpose, you know, as the saying goes, it's about more than a paycheck. Mm. And I can't imagine how the anxiety would also be racking me right now if I didn't have a thing to go and be with the people, even over Zoom, who we have a progress every day. And that progress works through our energy and works through our anxiety. So I have my own anxieties, but I never lose sight of the fact that I'm one of the lucky ones right now.
You've always been a guy who exudes gratitude. And one of, you know, you and I met, I don't know if you remember when we met, it was 2006. I had, my book was out. Your show, you know, was still relatively early at Comedy Central.
Wasn't even a year old.
Yeah. It was May of 2006. And you came into the green room and it was right after you had given, the White House Correspondents' Dinner speech.
So that would have been May of 2006.
Yeah. It was right after that. It was a moment where I think the country really understood the importance of your voice. And I would argue that the heroism of your voice. But also when you came back in that room and you're interviewing me, you know, I'm a young Iraq vet. You were very kind. You were always very humble. But I also could tell that that was a big moment. Like, I remember when I first stepped out and people started threatening me. I was in the arena. You know, my brother used to say he was worried more about political snipers here than he was about snipers when I was in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. But I remember you coming in the room and feeling that there was a pressure on you because of that. And I've always wanted to ask you, like, reflecting back on that time, now that you've got such a big platform and you're challenging the president every day, what did that feel like? And how do you reflect on that moment now?
Well, the first thing is, it's very, very nice of you. Very nice of you to say what you just said about that night. to me, I just really wanted to go do those jokes. You know, like, this is what I do. I didn't do anything different. It's not like I hit another gear to go do that. You just had to be willing to do it in front of the president and in front of the press and the Washington people you're talking about. That's all. But I guess a lifetime of not really caring about someone else's status sort of got me ready for that. And so that was those jokes were a magic carpet. I just got to fly over that part of the anxiety by riding on the jokes. And I had a really good time. You know, there was no sense for me while it was happening. I mean, I know I didn't want to go any closer to the president, you know, but I didn't want to necessarily go over and like hang with him afterwards. But I didn't get a sense until much later that there was any sense of like a whiff of brimstone in the room. You know, what you couldn't, and I know I've said this before, but what you couldn't hear at home was that there was a lot of laughter in the room. Right. The room's just not mic'd for laughter. Like, if you did a show at the Ed Sullivan Theater where I am and you didn't mic the audience, you would think that every monologue bombed, you know? And so it went okay. And it wasn't until it kind of got digested online and people started writing about it that became controversial. And I chose to hold on to that feeling I had on stage, and I just never talked about it. I never read anything about it because I saw how it blew up and I didn't want that to swallow my show because my show was so new.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, that's that thing that I did, but that's not the show. It's I used all the same skills, but I got to build this show here. So I kind of just, the pressure I felt was the pressure to do it again or the pressure to, you know, be like some sort of, wear my jokes like a suicide vest and run into places and blow them up. And I had no interest in doing that. I really kind of hoped the president would have laughed at those jokes. So the pressure I had was like, oh, I didn't want the crowd's enjoyment of that. And I mean the crowd at home, not the crowd in the room. The sort of the roar that came in the days after that from people having appreciated what I and my writers tried to do that night. I didn't want that to take over and to be sort of led by the crowd as opposed to try to lead it. You know what I mean? Like, and so I purposefully, and I had a conversation with Jon Stewart about this. Like, how do I do this? He goes, just don't ever talk about it, man. Mm. And eventually it'll just be a shine from that night, but not be what defines you as a performer. And so it's really only the last few years that I've wanted to talk about it at all. Cause I tried to be really, cognizant that, that wasn't everything that I wanted to do with the show. It didn't really want to always have the knives out. However much people might have perceived that as the sort of the legend of the evening is Colbert in there with his knives out. That's only part of the gig. So what you saw was my nervousness that maybe I had been my intention of the show had been subsumed by the intention of that one night. Hmm.
I think for me at the time, it gave me hope that someone would speak truth directly to power. You know, as I had just come home from Iraq recently, but now in retrospect, right? And I felt like it was the first time that the president had ever been called to task to his face in public. It was the first time anybody actually tried to hold him accountable in some way to his face.
Well, it wasn't popular at the time. You'll remember a lot of the reaction to that night. It was not a popular reaction. But listen, that's
Yeah,
I got some pretty dark correspondence.
I could feel that when you walked in the room because, you know, it was on a very different level. But when I spoke out about the war and I was one of the first to come home from Iraq and challenge Bush, we got a lot of death threats, dark stuff. Like I honestly didn't expect it. I kind of warned my dad and said, hey, Dad, you might want to, you know, change grandma's phone number because they can Google it and find her, you know? And he's like, if they come, I'll be waiting for him. I'm like, Dad, this is not that kind of level, okay? But I could feel that weight that you only understand if you're in the arena and you're truly challenging power.
All of that happened as well.
Yeah.
All of that happened as well. And of course, you worry for your family and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it cuts to the issue, you know, of integrity and courage, which I think has been a theme throughout your life and your career. Maybe the president's calling you right now. I don't know what that noise was.
I don't know what that was. I don't know how to make that not happen. Sorry.
It is all right. But you're also, you know, always giving back and people don't always see that. You know, you regularly supported veterans groups and so many other charities. You shaved your head and went to Iraq. Okay.
Now, you know, I just wanted to be like you, Paul. Well, I learned it from you.
I kept this in honor of you. So, you know, that was brave. But you're also a guy.
Was shave the head your idea?
I suggested it. I don't know if I was the only one who suggested
it. No, I think it was your idea. And I went, oh, that would be great. And then we could have Odierno like do it and the president could order him to do it. And then like
I didn't think you were really gonna do it.
And my staff worked so hard to actually make all that happen, but I believe shave the head was your idea.
I suggested it. I didn't think you were gonna do it. I don't know if it was the only person who suggested it. I thought you were gonna do some kind of bald cap or something funky, but there were no tricks.
Some people actually thought like, well, how will that in any way be resonant? Like, is that really good? And I was like, no, I bet. It's a joke, obviously, but it's a real joke. And I bet actually the people who have to have their head shaved will appreciate at least the effort.
Yeah. There aren't too many other people doing that. but it cuts to that you're a very down-to-earth guy. You're a humble guy. You're a relatable guy. Everybody who's been around you, you know, in informal settings is always struck by how down to earth you are. We are on the show always asking folks to share with us a little bit about themselves. So when you're, you know, offline and you're relaxing, I'll ask you the question I ask of all our guests. Stephen Colbert, what is your drink of choice?
Well, right now I'm having Diet Coke, but there's a lime in there to try to fool me to think there's a little rum in there too. But what's my drink of choice? Last night, I came home. I had some work to do, but all it required was for me to read some old scripts from 22 years ago that I wrote. I'm just, for a friend of mine, I'm doing a benefit and I'm reading some pilots that I wrote back when I was a young writer as part of this benefit Zoom that I'm going to do. And I had to go read them to see like, which one of these is what I want to do. And I said, I'm going to need a drink for this because I'm just going to see how much I sucked 22 years ago at writing. Not that I don't suck, you know, these days quite frequently, but so I poured myself a Mount Gay and tonic. That's it. Mount Gay and tonic. Mount Gay Eclipse. Don't get too fancy here. Just give me your basic Mount Gay. Mount Gay and tonic, two limes, maybe even a little splash of soda so it's not too sweet. I don't want anything to, don't drown it. I don't want to drown the Mount Gay. I want to know that I'm having a rum drink. And if I'm feeling super fancy, I'll have like an espresso martini. You know, that's my Red Bull and rum. That's my combo platter.
Rum and tonic. How did you get introduced to that? That's not one I've heard.
It's a sailor, kind of like Mount Gay and tonic is kind of a sailor drink. And yeah. I'm not a big sailor, but I know some. And one of them at a party was having that. I'm like, that looks fine. What's that? And he goes, let me go make you one. And that's, I'm in, baby. Mount Gay and tonic.
I love it. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to stay in the way, way back machine. You mentioned you were back in South Carolina. I think there's a lot of folks who hope you'll stay in South Carolina and run for office.
I can kill that dream right now. Because, you know, I did the Colbert Report for almost 10 years where I, with my name and this face, said with a straight face, unforgivable things in character. Can you imagine the ads that could be run against me based on the things that that character said? I said that Rosa Parks was overrated. I said, hey, don't get me wrong. I understand the monuments and everything, but let's not forget she was arrested for breaking the law. Are we honoring lawbreakers now? So that character is, thank God, that character will keep me from ever running for office.
Is that character more extreme than the character that the president played in The Apprentice and the character plays every day? I think this is a new environment, man. I think the bar is a lot lower than it used to be.
I know it is, but the funny you should say that is that I think sometimes the president will say things that nearly word for word what my character said.
Yeah.
And to the point, I'm like, was he watching? Like, did he watch that show?
Yeah.
Because he'll literally say things like, you know, I don't go with my brain, I go with my gut. It's actually the gut is more informed and stuff like that. Things that are literally from the opening thesis statement of that show. So is he more extreme? No, the president is more extreme.
Yeah.
The president is more extreme than my character, which is glad I don't have to do him anymore because I can't leapfrog that. I can't get further afield than this guy.
Well, since you won't run for South Carolina, I do want to keep your mind back in South Carolina. When you were growing up,
yeah,
I'm assuming it was in South Carolina.
And assuming I grew up.
Right. Stephen Colbert, what was your first car?
My first car was first owned, I think, by my sister Mary, and then by my brother Bill, and then Bill sold it to me for $1 right when I got out of college. And we like to say that he ripped me off because it was a 1977 powder blue Pinto.
Wow.
Yeah. And it had a serious rattle and I knew nothing about, I knew how to change brake pads and I knew how to change oil and like put brake fluid in. That was about all, I changed the tire. That's about all I knew how to do with the car. And it would rattle so bad that I would roll it over a ditch and keep it running and put the brake on and crawl underneath with a hammer, a screwdriver and a pair of pliers. And I would touch the hammer against things underneath the car. And if by touching that thing, it stopped rattling, I would remove that thing. And then the first place I lived out of college, there was a shelf in the garage. And there was a collection, a slowly building collection of rusted pieces of metal, the purpose of which I didn't know. I don't know, tailpipe, catalytic converter. I'm not sure what it was, And then just one day I removed one too many things and it didn't work anymore. Wow. And so I left it parked on the street in Chicago, essentially for the summer. And then you could just, because there was no alternate site parking, you could park in Chicago for months and months and months until there was snow. Then the first snow of more than 2 inches, all cars have to be moved so they can plow. And I didn't even think about it. And 2 weeks later, I went, oh, damn, there was a snow 2 weeks ago. I went and looked and it was gone. Wow. So I went to the city pound, which was in the way down in the city of Chicago you see from the lake. There's an area right near the lake called Lower Wacker Drive.
Which I know where that is. Yeah.
You know, so the impound, I went to the impound on Lower Wacker Drive down there, which is like a vision from Dante's Inferno. It's just hell on earth. And I went in and the number of fees I would have to have paid because, you know, every day I just went in there and I said, hey, can I just want to check out my car. And they said, okay. So I went and found the car. It was unlocked. I took some dry cleaning out of the back seat. I'd left some dry cleaning. I unscrewed the knob on the stick shift, put it in my pocket and I tossed them the keys and I walked away. And that was it. That was my first car.
Wow. Is the knob anywhere in that room you're sitting in now?
It's probably behind that door. There's a little storage door over there. It's probably in there. I've got a box, you know, Stevens memory box. It's probably in there.
Wow. Wow. Okay. That's amazing. I'm so glad I asked you that question. I didn't think it would disappoint. We had Norman Lear on recently and his answer was a Model T.
No.
Oh, yeah.
No. Model T. He's not that old.
Yeah, he is that old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. So we've had some great answers. But So speaking of the wheels coming off and things starting to fall apart,
yes,
and efforts to keep it together. Let me ask you a question. I think you've been, you know, a voice of reason, a conscience. You've helped so many people get through this time. I don't know if you've answered this question anywhere else before, but can you frame up this moment in time historically? You're a student of history. You're impacting history. I've talked a bit about how you're one of the people that's in a unique situation because you're living in the pandemic, you're covering the pandemic, and you're trying to influence the pandemic, but you're doing that in all aspects of what's happening in this country. So can you frame up for us, you know, how bad is this where we are right now? And what do you think, the future looks like?
I wouldn't call myself a student of history. I'm sort of a student of human behavior, you know, because like I've started off as an actor and I learned how to write and do comedy by improvising and then seeing that behavior and trying to script it. And so I kind of look at it from just like, I don't feel like I know a lot about politics, but I recognize hypocrisy because that's just a human behavior. Politics ends up being a very complex set of improvisational games that, the rules of which are rarely said out loud. And then because that there is a truth to that, some people perceive it only as game. And then you have voter suppression, which is just all part of the game, man, but no part of the spirit of the idea of democracy. So anyway, I'm interested in the way humans behave and some people, you know, say one thing and act in another way. And the difference between the arc there, between what they purport to do and what they actually do, the jokes all land in that little arc there. Mm-hmm. The closer it comes, the harder it is to make the joke. But right now, it's like that. We believe one thing, we do another. So it's open field running, if you know what I mean.
Right.
What do I think of the moment? I think it's a hazardous moment because people lose faith in institutions. And one of my writers is from Colombia, and he said this morning in the pitch meeting, he goes, hey, by the way, I just want to say that I know like it can't really happen, but that's actually what everyone says right before it happens.
Mm.
Everyone, but before an autocracy actually takes over, what they say is, and I'm speaking to you as a Latin American, the last thing people say is, okay, they're doing all the things that would lead to it, but it won't really happen. Or they don't really mean it, or this is just game playing. Mm-hmm. So where are we? We're in a very dangerous spot right now where truth has been devalued. There is, if you pardon the expression, an epistemological crisis within the Republican Party where things cannot be known. We can't know what's happening with global warming. Mm-hmm. We can't, We can't know how many votes there were. We won't know. The statement saying we will never know who the winner is a very dangerous thing to say. Some things are knowable. We won't know, can't know how many people have died of COVID. We don't really know what the right thing to do is. All of that is to say, my opinion is as declarative as fact. And so since things can't be known, and if you'll accept my opinion as declarative and as definitive as fact on all these other things, if you accept all of these things incrementally, the boiling frog, as it were, in the water, that when we get to the point of can't know who won the election, then my declarative and definitive opinion is just as good as you sitting around counting ballots. Therefore, the election is not necessary. Now, will that actually happen? I don't think so. And of course, that could very well be wrong. But this is all just to get to the last question you gave is, what does this moment mean, or where is this moment going? We won't know till November 3rd. What is the future of this country is completely dependent on what happens on November 3rd. There is no doubt that we are at a critical moment in our country. Not only things like the chickens of racial injustice coming home to roost right now, again. But also our decades long running away from fact and our need to bury our head in the sand, in the consoling sands of ignorance. And some of it has to do with that we're really in a moment of loss. You know, this is a moment of great loss for people individually, not only the loss of life, the loss of loved ones, loss of human connection right now. You know, we're societal animals, and not to be able to each other is this loss, emotional loss for ourselves. That's hard to take a toll of, hard to measure the toll it takes. We're also in a loss of the threatened preeminence of the United States on the world stage. You know, not only because in the last few years we've alienated our allies, which everybody needs friends, and our strength comes not only through military power. You know, what you've done with your life and what you've learned, and the value and the necessity of that, but also the soft power that is required through diplomacy and trade. And we're in a moment we're threatened to lose that, but also just the raw economic power of a new rising world force like China. So those make Americans nervous, and we also have Donald Trump himself, if pardon me saying the name. Is something like a loss of innocence for America as well. There's some loss of innocence there. And it's happened before. I mean, during Nixon, there was a loss of innocence, certainly concerning how we perceived the presidency, a loss of our sense of invincibility with Vietnam, a loss of our preeminence on the world stage with the oil crisis, which led to an economic crisis and collapsing of jobs in the Rust Belt. Even down to things like, you know, you're too young to remember, but Marilyn Chambers was a porn star in the 1970s who turned out to have been the Ivory Snow Girl. Like there was some sense of like loss of innocence there. And when people are feeling loss, they react in extreme ways because they're afraid. And that fear leads to anger, and different things can happen. You can march in the streets, demand your rights, or you can hand those rights over to someone who says, I'll just take care of you. And I think that's where we are. Some people are marching the streets, demanding their rights and demanding that things be known. And other people are handing the keys over to somebody who says, don't worry, I'll know everything. I'll decide everything. You just follow me and it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. So, but all of it, I think, is a response to a sense that America is in a moment of loss here. A loss of some things we love. It's perfectly human. It's perfectly natural. It's perfectly normal. It's historically common, but the things that makes the difference are political, philosophical, moral, ethical underpinnings of America, and normally the leadership that points to those things. And now we lack that leadership to point to those things. America is just as great as it's ever been, but we're being pointed in the wrong direction. Leadership matters. They say elections have consequences. These are the consequences of the last election.
Hmm. I'm so glad you brought it back there, because I think that leadership is the defining factor right now, and leadership is missing in so many ways. But leaders are also rising to the moment and shaping the moment, and are standing in the wings to take us through the next moment. But I think your leadership has been important, weaving together part of what you talked about, in that this is a loss for our country. This is a tragedy. We are losing opportunity. We're losing time. We're losing life. There's a real sense of loss and tragedy around what's happened, and I think driven in large part by the leadership failures of this president. But I remember one of the more powerful conversations I've ever seen on television was your conversation with Joe Biden, talking about loss, where you both showed tremendous personal, powerful vulnerability. You shared how you both had faced unspeakable loss and how you've gotten through that. And I think it puts us in a position where, whether you know it or not, you're helping people deal with that loss now, and you're helping us get through it. And I think that's why Joe Biden is well positioned to take us through the next phase, because he can be a consoler in chief. He understands loss. He understands the wreckage and tragedy that will come after Trump, and he can help guide us through it, hold our hand, and give us some wisdom. But there's also anger out there. And you know, part of why I did this show is to play with anger in the same way you used to play with conservatism, right? And recognize that anger can go in a lot of directions, but it's a natural reaction. And how you choose to react to that reaction, it makes the difference, right? If you're not angry, you're not paying attention, especially this week with everything from the Supreme Court situation to Breonna Taylor, to Trump saying he may not leave office if he loses. If you're not angry, you're not paying attention. But we can turn that anger into positive impact. You've done that. You turn all those emotions into some solace and I think some positivity and some hope for people. But you're human. You get angry too. Stephen Colbert, what makes you angry?
Well, this might be too long of an answer, because the long part is before I ever get to the answer, which is that I have this ongoing feeling about anger itself, which is that anger is generally not the feeling you're feeling. Mm. Is that anger is often the armor you wear to not feel the actual feeling or not show the actual feeling. And because, for instance, whether it's no action taken regarding specifically the death of Breonna Taylor. I know the charges for reckless endangerment happened to one of those three officers, but nothing regarding Breonna Taylor. Well, that makes people feel powerless. Especially when the attorney general says, "I there's nothing I can do. The laws do not allow me to bring charges here." Or Ginsburg dies. Look, they're perfectly within their power to do what they're doing. There's no debating that. They're perfectly within their power to appoint somebody else. And that powerlessness on behalf of the people who say, but you have no honor. Look how you will lie and do anything in your naked pursuit of that power. That powerlessness you feel, well, that lack of agency creates fear. Because you're like an animal with their hand caught in a trap. And then that fear, no one wants to feel fear. It's the last thing you want to feel. And maybe even more than grief, you don't want to feel fear. And so you cover the fear with anger. And there are other responses that are possible to fear. But anger is the evolutionarily successful response, and it's proven itself valuable. I'm not saying that it's the wrong thing to do. I'm just saying it's just one of the responses you can have. But anger, as Yoda reminds us, leads to hate, and hate leads to the dark side. And so there's another thing you do with fear is you can identify the thing that makes you fearful and then say, what is the only agency you have? What agency can I have here? Is there any move I can make? And so what makes me angry right now? What makes me angry right now? What makes me angry is a sense of, what makes me angry really is people saying there's nothing you can do. Giving up makes me angry. People saying he's going to win. Or people saying the Democrats don't know what they're doing. No, the responsibility is yours. Go vote. There is something you can do. You must never give up on the sense of your own personal power in this democracy. Now, if you didn't live in democracy, that'd be one thing. But in a democracy, you are never allowed to give up hope. You are never allowed to surrender. You're never allowed to say, let anger be the last step for you. Go vote. Keep your sense of personal agency. Do something. Get somebody else to vote. Giving up makes me angry. Because the anger I have about those other things, I work that through. I work through that on a daily basis. And we come together. We share our anger with each other. We, you know, use whatever we've learned over the last couple of decades of doing this work, and we try to turn that into jokes by the end of the day. Jokes that have a knife in them sometimes, but they're jokes. You know, it's a snowball with a stone in the middle, but it's a snowball. And, you know, if that can make somebody less afraid, because you can't laugh and be afraid at the same time, as I've said before, that makes them less afraid, then they can think. And they can think of a way to get their hand out of that trap. And generally speaking, that is, it can be protesting, it can be voting, it can be writing, it can be creating art, can change lives for other people by taking their fear away, giving them a sense of community. But the people who are most making you feel powerless and leads to that anger, most want you to feel hopeless. Most want you to feel no sense of community. Most want you to feel that there's nothing they can you can do to stop their march toward non-democratic and I would say non-humanist answers.
Thank you for that. I was hoping we could go on that journey. And really. I mean, that's Frank, it's why I was excited about the podcasting format where we can talk, right, in a way that lets us explore ideas and really, you know, share what we want to say in its fullness, right? And hearing you do that in this conversation is so important, because I think it does underscore the kind of kind leadership that you not just you ask for and you require, but you demonstrate. And I am concerned, I'm deeply concerned that part of the failure of our leadership right now is that they are not preparing everyone for the long haul. And leaders have an obligation to be upfront with people. And I worry that too many think that November is the end. And I'm looking at it as maybe the late third quarter, maybe the fourth quarter with a lot of overtime. And we might have 2, 3, 4 overtimes, sure, right? And I think voices and leaders like yours are going to be critical to take us through what could be many tough years, right? I mean, only people who've never been to war think it's easy and simple. And now we're in this, and I think you and others are going to be so critical in helping us through this complex and evolving battlefield on everything from the pandemic to Trump to the election results to, you know, the national security threats. But you consistently bring hope. And that's important because it's lacking from our leadership. And you bring happiness. You do channel all those emotions and turn them into a very powerful snowball. And so I want to ask you the other question I ask of all of our guests. Stephen Colbert, what makes you happy?
Well, I really like my dog. I really do like my dog. He's still only a year old, so he still will chew very valuable things. Ai Weiwei. Julia, there's a Chinese artist, dissident.
Yeah,
artist.
Amazing.
He sent, and not just to me, but he sent around these hand-printed masks, COVID masks, to sort of point at the need for masks with a signed letter from Ai Weiwei, like this. My dog fucking ate it. Sorry for the salty talk, but my dog ate two. I've got two of the masks left. He ate two pieces of hand-printed art by Ai Weiwei. I'm like, fucker, I could send you to college on that shit. Now I don't have the complete set. And I'm sure you're watching. Can you please just send me another set? I just wanted to frame it. So he makes me mad too, but I love him anyway. Of course, my family makes me happy. Seeing my kids doing okay, you know, like yep. Knowing my kids are all right, you know, that they're happy, that's good. But what else makes me happy? Comedy, man. I'm so lucky. I get to hang out. My Rolodex, as my friend Tom likes to say, my Rolodex is filled with the funniest people on the planet. Mm. Professionally funny people. And if I'm really down, I can call them and go, hey, what's going on with you? And we will make each other laugh. And I always feel better at the end of it. Laughter really does. I'm not going to say best medicine, but it is an excellent psychotropic drug. It can actually put you in another place so you can have another point of view about what's going on right now. So, you know, I like to say, you know, why I feel better today? Because jokes. Because jokes, you know.
That's great.
Fear is the mind killer. And if you're laughing, you're not afraid. I mean, I know I'm repeating myself, but it really makes a huge difference. Mm. You know, there is a tyranny. There is a tyranny that wants to make you feel powerless. And jokes always, at the very least, you can laugh at the devil. Mm. And he cannot abide mockery. Mm. And it's just great to know that that's always there for you. You always have that in your pocket. You just laugh out loud. And that really makes you feel like, oh, well, shit, I've got some purpose in my life. I mean, it's not everybody. Not everybody digs your, you know, your shtick. But those who do, you're making their day a little bit better. And that's just enormous. Even if you're talking about some sometimes dark things, if you're just making them feel a little bit better about it, that makes me happy to know I'm making somebody else's day a little bit better. That's a great gift. You know, that's, I get so much back. If the show goes well, I got more energy at the end of it than the beginning of it.
I love it. And that energy is contagious. And it's also the flip side is contagious too. I don't know if we've ever had a less funny president than Trump. He's so unfunny. I mean, he makes George Bush look like you. I mean, it's like
he can do a joke, but only cruel jokes. And you never really see him laugh. That's the weird.
There's no fun. There's no happiness. There's no humor. And that, in that command climate, as we called it in the military, is contagious. And that energy is contagious. And that's why we need the happiness and we need the laughter. Anybody who's been through a hard time knows that. And that's why I think what you're doing is performing a tremendous public service. You're a patriot, and this country, in my view, is at war in so many different ways. It feels like war. It sounds like war. It hurts like war.
Yep.
And we need laughter. I've said before, especially for the troops and veterans, you're like the Bob Hope of our generation.
Bob Hope kept it going. I haven't done it in a while, and that's on me. But Bob kept it going for a while, and I want to get back to that. I would like to get back to that.
You're gonna keep it going.
Please. Can I ask you a question?
Of course. I
had H.R. McMaster on the other night.
Yep.
And at one point, he mentioned that we had taken the show overseas, and we had done some stuff for the troops, and I said, well, it at the time it felt like the troops were what I was hearing from friends that I knew in the service, the troops felt like they were being ignored and their experiences were being ignored because America was suddenly gazing at its own navel with the economic crisis of 2008, 2009 and thereafter. And he said, yes, we still have wars going on around the world right now. And I almost stopped him and said, what are those wars?
Mm.
Like, what are those? Because they're spoken of so little right now that I wanted to hear somebody who, I mean, he's no longer serving as the Hoover Institute right now, but where are these people? Where are our troops, our men and women being stationed right now? I'd love for you to tell me, where are the people that we're not thinking about right now? Because I know we still have troops in the Middle East. I know we still have forces in Afghanistan. I know we still have forces in some parts of Iraq and Syria. I know there's probably some forces in Central or South America,
The short answer is they're everywhere, right? And now they're also fighting wildfires in California, and they're in the DMZ in South Korea. And they are often forgotten, and they're often rising to the challenge in ways that are subtle. And I think, you know, I think we had a real challenge for so long because people didn't understand war. Less than 0.5% served. Everybody else was doing their thing. After COVID, I think everybody understands a little differently. I think they feel a threat. They know what it is to think about safety all the time. They know what it's like to pull your family close and to think about your will and to know how you could die at any moment. I think that is different. And it's connecting us in a way that we could have never been connected unless we were all under a unified threat. I went to Israel once and was exploring how they were caring for their troops and doing mental health. And I talked to a provider and I asked him about how they related to civilians and how hard it must be to connect with civilians. He said, everybody over here has PTSD. We're all worried about rockets falling on us, civilians or soldiers. So there was that connectivity, and so many other places around the world feel that too. So they are everywhere. But in this war, we're all troops. We all need to pick up what we can and get involved, whether it's a pen or, you know, a joke or a rifle. And I think right now, well, I'm glad you brought up McMaster's, because I think we are again being terribly failed by our leadership. I am terribly disappointed in McMaster's and in Milley and in General Mattis and in General Kelly, because they're pulling their punches and yes. They can't hide behind the stars, because they put the stars on the shelf and said, I am now a political actor. So they can't have it both ways, and they're trying to have it both ways. And I think they right now have an opportunity not just to influence the way people vote, but the way people think about our national security. Because I think the biggest thing Trump's done is made us vulnerable in so many ways that our enemies are celebrating. And I use the hashtag all the time, our enemies are celebrating. So I think they have a moral responsibility, a national security imperative, to tell the American people what they know, because it can get worse. This guy has his finger on the nukes, and it can always get much worse, and it could get worse before November. So I am terribly disappointed in the political and military leadership of our generation. I think they are failing us in ways that dwarf what happened in Vietnam, and I think they're failing the American people in ways that dwarf what happened in Vietnam and Iraq and any other time.
So, I don't know what the ethos of commander leadership is and within the military, but it seems to me that, I mean, I know it's important, but I don't know what the prescribed responsibilities of leadership are. But it seems to me that having to chase these men to say, tell us the truth, does not seem like leadership. You shouldn't have to chase the leader around and say, tell us what the truth is, because we know you're hiding something. Or rather, it's a sin of omission that you will not share. I'm not saying you're actively trying to hide something, but what is the difference between that and the sin of omission? Because, you know, I asked General McMaster's the other day, I said, well, you say that the Russian interference in elections is the single greatest national security threat to the United States, and we know that the president denies that it's happening. So is the president then a national security threat? And he wouldn't.
They won't answer. They never answer it. And that's like, it's literally like failing to acknowledge that Osama bin Laden is a part of Al-Qaeda's network and terrorism and everything else that spawned thereafter. I mean, they won't say his name. They won't. They talk about leadership, and they talk about accountability, and they talk about integrity, and they talk about our divisions in generality, without recognizing that one person singularly is setting the command climate and making those decisions. So I think it's a total failure of leadership. I think it's a failure of integrity when they allow him, when General Milley and Secretary Esper allow him to walk them out into Lafayette Park, where National Guardsmen are intimidating peaceful protesters. They were used. And I think if they had any integrity, they would have resigned. They would have said, I won't be used another day. I'm out of here. So I think the failures have been very, very, very severe. I think they damage our democracy. I think they damage the trust in our military, especially at a time right now. If Trump rolls the National Guard into Louisville, there are a lot of people who fear that the military is his ground force in a race war. And they're not. And if these guys don't speak out, then Trump will be allowed to continue to manipulate the military in a way that is so damaging, in the same way he manipulates anger and religion and so many other things. So, you know, veterans are supposed to be the guardians of the democracy. The military is supposed to be the keeper of the flame. If America was a religion, we're supposed to be the clergy. And I think that they are failing, and we got to call them out. Some of the guardrails are working, Stephen, but too many of them are failing. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, right now your patriotic demonstration every day is more profound and more impactful than McMaster's. You know, McMaster should be asking you questions about leadership, not the other way around.
I would never put myself in that position over him, given the service he's given this country, but that's nice of you to say. What interests me is, we talk about the divisions in the country, like people like McMaster talks about the divisions, and you said Kelly and Mattis and people in the generalities. I wish that I felt like our present leadership liked Americans, that they just liked us. I mean, I have massive disagreements with people in my own family. I love them, though. We have to still, I love Americans. I mean, I like human beings, and Americans are human beings. Let's not put ourselves above other human beings. But I really like Americans. I just don't understand how our president of the United States and the people around him seem to not like the majority of Americans.
Because, well, he doesn't like himself. I mean, I'm not, you know, just taking us back to where you were before, but I mean, there's an insecurity and a lack of integrity. I keep talking about it. He's a terrible person. He's a terrible person. I think he's a piece of shit. I think he's a terrible person. And you can't build any foundation on something that's so broken. So everything he does is broken. Everything. This is who he is. He is a terrible person. You wouldn't trust. Somebody used to tell me, you know, you want people around that you can trust with your wallet and your kids. Right. And you can't trust him with either. You can't trust him with anything, and because he lacks integrity, because he's a terrible person. And that's the core of everything. So I said, you know, Joe Biden is not perfect, but you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And he's good. He's a good person. And I'll take good over catastrophically terrible and diabolically awful. I will take that. And that's our choice. But you are.
Give him a chance. Give him a chance, Paul. Come on. Give him a chance.
Yeah, give him a chance. Give him a chance.
He's had 3 years and 8 months.
Give him a chance of the pandemic and the nukes and race wars and everything else. No, no, thank you. The stakes are too high. You know, just like in the military, you don't get a second chance to screw up a war, ideally, right?
Do you know, it interests me. I just read Bob Woodward's book, and in that, he clearly is having first-person conversations with Mattis and Dan Coats and Tillerson and maybe even Jared Kushner and everything. It really seems like he's actually speaking to all these people. And usually those books are, I was asked to serve. I was hesitant. My family convinced me it was the right thing to do. So I came to the call. As the years went on, it occurred to me that it's immediate. All of them immediately go like, I immediately knew that this was a disaster. I immediately knew there's nothing I could do. And I'm struck by how quickly the people, every single person who ever spends time with him and then leaves of any note or of any level of integrity goes, that's a dangerous man who has no moral compass. I can't believe that that's the guy who's calling the shots. And I don't know what motivates. I always think that people, you know, act in their own self-interest. Even people who act altruistically believe that what is good for everyone will be good for me. It's not like anyone out there is not voting to make their own lives or the family's lives better. I just don't perceive what this basement of 42% of Americans think that Trump is doing for them. What I'm confused, and that confusion can lead to anger, and anger can lead to hate, and hate can lead to the dark side. But that's another thing that makes me angry. Confusion makes you angry. Confusion makes you angry. And so I do get confused, and I try not to lead to anger. I get confused by the people who can look at 200,000 dead and a cratered economy and a president who would take no responsibility, not even respond to the knowledge that 200,000 people have died. He was asked 2 days ago, why haven't you said anything about why haven't you acknowledged 200,000 people dying of COVID? And he looked at the reporter, then looked to the left and said, anyone else?
Yeah.
That is shocking. I'm not exactly sure what sustenance you are getting politically, spiritually, yeah, emotionally, intellectually. What are you getting from a man like that?
Well, we're not getting anything. That's why he needs to go. I mean,
it feels like they're getting something. I don't know.
Well, I think that the people who continue to support him, I think, you know, fall in two categories. Either they don't know any better for some reason or another, or they think they have something to gain personally. That's it. I mean, for me, it's in two categories, right? And everybody else is on the other side. And I think it's, you know, it is a defining point for the integrity of every individual in this country. Like when you go to the ballot box, you're making a character statement, yeah, in my view. And you're making, you know, a statement on the character of the future of this country. So I'm with you. I still love Americans. I don't love them all. I mean,
they're, no, neither do I, but that's the part I do. Cause I actually really do want to understand, yeah, because there is something on the other side of this.
Sure.
You know, there's a reason why Lincoln talked about the better angels of our nature, is that there had to be something on the other side of all of this for the country to come back together. And I'm not saying that there has to be like a truth and reconciliation committee, yeah, but there has to be some reckoning to these years, yeah, of what's going on.
I think that's right. I mean, I always hope that this will end with him in handcuffs, because I think that we need that statement for the future, for our children, and to the world. We need to show people that there is accountability in America for this level of destruction to America. And that's what my hope is. I don't know how likely it is, but I think there needs to be public accountability where the world sees that he is held accountable by the American people beyond the ballot box. But we may not see that day. In the meantime, we got to have leaders like you that take us through it. And I think hearing you talk in this way, I hope, underscores for people your deep level of patriotism. And I use that word carefully, but I think you're a true patriot. And at a time when we need patriots who care about this country and not about a party or an ideology and care about the future. And you've been that for a long time. And those of us who know you know that and have seen that. And I'm just grateful for your leadership example. You're a guy that we can look up to and tell our kids, that's a man who has honor and integrity, does things the right way, treats people the right way, and you can be like him. Trump is a guy, don't be like Trump, right? My kid thinks he's the Grinch. He says he's a lot like the Grinch. Don't be like Trump. But Stephen Colbert is a person that people can be like, and we're grateful for you, and I want you to know that. And I have gifts for you. You look like you may want to interrupt me, but I want to keep you on the timeline.
I'm going to interrupt you just by saying that's very nice of you to say. I think of myself as like a leader of my show, and we do the show for the people, you know, who are watching it. And if that provides something else to them, that's great. My objective is to lead my show and to do the show for the people out there. Not that I'm not denying the compliment you gave me. That's very nice of you to say, but I am myself indifferent, honest, yet I could accuse me of such things. It were better my mother had not borne me. So every man knows his own heart, and I wish I was a better person.
Well, the fact that you say that underscores that you are a good person and you're working at it every day tenaciously. In the meantime, I have some gifts for you. We would normally do this in person and we would share a cocktail. We can't do that right now. So I'm going to quickly virtually present you with some gifts. I've got some Angry Americans gear made by the veterans of Oscar Mike. It's super comfortable. And excellent. It would match that Martin guitar hat you have, which I think is so cool, because anybody who knows about guitars knows that Martins are awesome.
They are, yeah.
And next I have some whiskey for you. It is Uncle
Nearest. Not much, evidently.
No, I drank some of it. But it's Uncle Nearest, which has a fantastic story. They're big supporters of this show. It's fantastic whiskey. Going to send that your way.
Is that a rye? Is that a corn mash? What is that?
No, it's a small batch whiskey. And it's just, they're called the smoothest whiskey in Tennessee. I hope you don't mind going across the border to drink whiskey from Tennessee. It was named after Nearest Green, who is the former slave who taught Jack Daniels how to make whiskey. Jeffrey Wright introduced us to this, and it's also awesome.
You have
to replace your own. And then
I'm in.
The last gift, which is also a question, it's kind of the Rorschach test of our show. We have three colors of Peeps. We've done this with every guest from the beginning. And I will ask you, Stephen Colbert, blue, yellow, or pink, which color of Peeps would you choose and why?
Yellow. Because I'm an originalist, and Peeps were originally meant to replace Easter chicks that people used to put in Easter baskets. Like, so they would actually give kids chicks like at Easter as like, you know, it was a kind of joke about you had the eggs, but then they hatched overnight. So there were chicks in there. And the other ones, the pink and the blue, was sometimes people would dye the actual chicks to be the color of the eggs and everything. So I would go with the yellow because they're meant to be Easter chicks that you would put in a basket, which thankfully people don't do anymore because the things did not end well for those chicks. So I'd go with yellow.
There's always a lesson in these answers. You are a student of history, and you're also a teacher and a professor, and you're guiding us through these perilous times. I'm honored to have you as a friend. I'm so grateful that you joined us on this show and had this conversation with me. You've been doing so many good things for this country for so long. And I want you to know it's appreciated, especially in the veterans and military community, but by so many people in this country and around the world. I am so, so grateful for your friendship and your example and all that you do for this country.
Well, Paul, I'm grateful for your friendship too. Thanks so much. And thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for going out there and, you know, trying to find out why we're all so angry right now. What we can do to get happy. I want this to turn into happy Americans this time next year.
All right. You know, if we have a new president, it will definitely be happier Americans. Thank you. Thank you, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, the great and powerful Stephen Colbert. Stay frosty, my friend.